Session number 10699.
Jones Reel 7. You were talking about when you joined your battery, which was to be an 18-pounder A battery of 74 Brigade.
Yes.
If you could continue. You were saying that they were in the line to the left of Passchendaele, up front.
To the north of Passchendaele, yes, on the left. In fact, it was on the left. Our left wing coincided with the right wing of the French Second Corps. A marvelous lot of huge men who had been in that awful time after Verdun, you know, when they said, well, we're not going to fight anymore. We won't leave the place, but we are going to be just cannon fodder. And then Pétain did his marvelous business of saving lives, which is very interesting to me always, because you see, he was such a traitor in the Second War, Vichy, and it really was a mistaken determination to save men's lives. He didn't want us fighting like so many of the French didn't. So, at any rate, there we were.
How did you cope? Because the whole of the battery command had been killed, basically, and just a couple of junior officers. How did you cope before the, in this early period of joining the battery?
Oh, the next day they put a fellow called Harland.
Harland?
Who was, he was a senior subaltern, and he took command of the battery. And this other fellow, the Scotsman who met me down the lines, he went down. The captain's job was normally to be at the wagon lines, you see? Be with the wagon lines and take over if the CO was killed or put out. So this was just over the Yser Canal, and the bridge that went over it was made by our fellows or reconstructed by our fellows. And when my great school friend, Hoss Brown, was working, this was before I went out, just before I got out, he was forward mending or putting together this little bridge over the canal. He was killed by an 8-inch German shell. And there wasn't a mark on him. He was killed by the blast. And that was only about 50 yards from my battery position. It was very unhealthy there because the Germans had got the Yser Canal taped naturally because everything would be coming over there. And although very little could come at all, and any ammunition for us was coming from the wagon lines, where the divisional ammunition column had delivered it there, and our fellows were coming up with the four shells and fuses to each side of the horse, and walking them up the 5 miles and finishing up in the mud. And the famous Charles Vickery, who was screaming offensive things to the signals because they couldn't get him this and that, and the signal officer himself, we generally found him wandering over to us and saying, what are you doing here, Percival? And he'd say, well, the CO sent me here to stay with you because he can't stand me any longer because I can't get him talking to all the battery commanders at the same time.
This was the problem with keeping the wires intact that you referred to earlier.
No, no, no. It wasn't a question of good. He was demanding the impossible, actually, for this field telephone business. And, but who was the chap, the only CO for Miles, who had great containers outside his pillbox headquarters, the famous thing which it butt right into me, the house with the leaning tree, which comes later, of course. Outside there, for these chaps who were dragging themselves up with the horses and ammunition, were hot drink for them. Of course, they didn't care being screamed at down the phone if they could have that at the same time. And
so he was considerate.
They were marvellous, the chaps up there. And the signallers, of course. I think I can be said of signallers generally. They were quite incredibly brave. And I was able to get a number of them decorated, actually, because they were quite extraordinary. Generally, there we were, in the mud, very unpleasant conditions indeed. And there was a French battery just on our flank. And this was the famous 75, you know. Marvellous. 22 rounds a minute. What they call tir forchon. That is to say that it increased automatically and at the same time drifted from right to left and so on. The effect was terrific, although it was a very light shell. And they didn't have officers at the OP watching the shells. They had what they call the adjutant, which wasn't an officer rank, people doing the spotting. When I talked to some of the chaps, the actual French batteries, they used to cast their officers behind because some of the stuff fell short on them, you see. And they'd put up SOS signals, and that meant that the people behind would double the rate of fire. But they were terribly good, as I found later in attack when they were alongside me. Marvellous fellows, I thought. And these were the blokes who were the so-called strikers.
I believe, it's a general point really, but Vickery had some unwritten rules. You mentioned in your, he had ways of behaving that he insisted from his officers. Could you run through them and sort of tell us a bit more about them? What did he want from his officers?
Well, it came first of all, I think, from the question of language. He said to all his young officers, "Don't let me ever catch you using these effing words." He said, "Bloody is the officer's word, and don't let me catch you using anything else." And then he'd say, "It's the duty of all of us to train ourselves to have the same degree of courage and so on that the guards have." And he said, "There's absolutely no necessity for us to be more uncomfortable than we need. And first of all, we are going to have books to read." "We're going to have books to read, and everybody's going to contribute, all the officers, half a crown. And we'll go to Hugh Rees in London and get them to send out books to us at a time, and then we'll have another half crown sent around. And when we finish reading them, we'll give them to the troops to read, and then we'll send them to the hospitals finally." And these were things that a lot of people don't think about, you know, which were excellent. And we had always crates of beer coming out, the officers' mess. We had all sorts of things coming out all the time. And Because, you see, we could spare a little money there. We had nothing to spend our pittance on. And so we were very proud of these things. And another thing was, although it was pushing the troops rather hard, they delighted in it in the end. We used to have all the parts painted out in our vehicles and our guns and so on. It was at a very large German pillbox where we had to stand behind. I have pictures I took of this later, which had really sunk into my memory very well, because we had our signalers and ourselves behind, sort of peeping around the corner over this vast mud field, which was the battlefield. And Colonel Vickery used to come up and stand behind and wave his map and say, "Now, where are we?" It was all right, he was going back, but the Germans would think that a very good target. But he then said, "Now, look, there's a German, dead German lying on a wire bed inside there, and it's up to you." He didn't tell me detail enough. He said, "You and your chaps, you must get him out of it, because we must get the signalers inside." Yeah. So he told me it was absolutely appalling. Somebody got rid of this, his head and shoulders, and the other his legs. They got him outside in this appalling stench, and he came in half, so to speak. It's a horrible story, but at any rate, it meant that we had a very good home for the troops. And when I went back after the war and took my pictures, which I have now, one of them is of Widgeon Drift, and one of them was from the view standing on the top of Widgeon Drift. I think at this point I ought to say that the Passchendaele battle went so wrong because we didn't know how to handle all this mud and trouble of the sort. The Germans, on the other hand, they didn't defend it with men in the first place. They made all these pillboxes. We never made pillboxes. We never made a pillbox at all. And Vickery's headquarters was in the next German pillbox. And the fact that we were firing barrages, early morning barrages, didn't mean a thing. Because the Germans weren't out in the open. They were either in very strongly fortified points or in these concrete pillboxes, you see. So that to go and put down a barrage, it was like the Somme over again, only worse in a way. Because you put down this barrage if this cursed shells that we used were having any effect. And they weren't hitting anything. Nothing at all. So they might as well have saved it, you see.
What were the ground conditions like in this area around Widgeon Drift pillbox?
Oh, it was everywhere. Mud. Mud, vast mud. And when I took the pictures, which you've got, of course, a vast growing up of wild stuff. All the shell holes, which had been full of water, were sprouting bulrushes and so on. It was a very wild effect, you see. But in those days, it was just mud with duckboards running across it. And so that if you got off those, for example, after the next big advance, our troops were lying out in shell holes full of water, and gassy water at that, mustard gas. No wonder that this fellow, one of the most senior staff officers, when he came and saw that area afterwards, he said, "Do you mean to say that we sent men to fight in that?" And burst into tears. Well, it was a bit too late to burst into tears.
How long were you, now? Widgeon Drift was the forward observation post. How long would you be there? How long were you there as forward observation officer? Would you be there in sort of 3 days on, 3 days off? What was it, a day?
Oh, no, you weren't there. No. No, you weren't there at night, you see, because you worked then on SOSs and so on. But your guns were on SOS lines, and if there was any trouble started, you started pooping off. No.
So you just went up in the day to the forward observation
post? You were there in the day,
And then back to the battery?
Then back to the battery, yeah.
So you'd have to do quite a lot of travelling in this terrible terrain.
No, frankly, no, because you've got your duckboards down, you see. The French battery on our left, they'd got a little rising ground. Ours was higher than eventually we went down to at that particular point. The French in the battery were able even to get a fairly deep dugout down in their part. And I visited there quite a lot to drink brandy with them. They were a great lot. Yes, well, it wasn't far ahead, you know. You looked over this vast thing, but it wasn't a fact of going up to near the front, which was down below on the famous Steenbeek then. And any further advance, the next advance, was to get your guns down onto the line of the fetid Steenbeek. At this stage of the Passion d'Ail, or Third Ypres battle, it is useful to look into why it had become quite hopeless to get a favourable result. The first object of this left of the Allied battle line, which was the British at Ypres, the French on our left, the Iron Corps of two divisions, one and two, and the Belgians on the left again. All the principles of war, as far as the British High Command are concerned, were negatives and avoided. Of course, the first great one is surprise. And what we were trying to do over that and the past year was to clear the left of the line so that the Belgian ports could be open to us with contact with Britain. This is awfully important of getting reserves across and so on, and all the paraphernalia of war. This we completely failed to do, and we were warned, even by some of our higher staff, that it was a hopeless business. And as soon as the battle started, the conditions were bad enough then, but the stupid bombardment, for the wrong bombardment, completely destroyed the very tricky conditions there. We destroyed our own drainage system, and so it was hopeless from the start. Nevertheless, Haig was pushed on by some of his enthusiasts and by his own stupidities. And so the other things came into context. That is, the principles of war were, you must go up forward, senior staff. This is proved in the case of Passchendaele, because at the end of the battle, one of the highest promoting staff went up there, and having seen that shocking sight of the battlefield, the mud, and the shocking casualties we had, burst into tears and said, did I send the troops into this? Why hadn't he been up forward? Why was the Duke of Wellington at the Waterloo sitting on a horse right forward and sending his aides still further forward in contact with the troops? All this had been forgotten. As far as the gunners were concerned, they called this the Gunner War in some places. This is right in one respect. It doesn't stop us giving the infantry the first consideration when they were shoved into impossible positions, as I will describe in our part of the line later. At any rate, what you had was this terrible shrapnel, which I think I've described in the Somme battle as having almost lost the war for us. Now, in order to get any result at all from shrapnel, it's tricky enough because you never know exactly where a round is going to fall. You must be able to get troops in the open. It's quite useless in shooting it. And in Passchendaele, what the senior staff didn't realize, or even some of the junior staff in divisions, was that you must get your observation officers forward so that you can correct anything that was wrong. Apart from that, the Germans had adopted, and this was well known, had adopted a defense in depth. They had these pillbox, these strong points, no troops in the open, and no trenches, of course. And we had nothing to shoot at, and particularly with this futile shrapnel, because the Germans were in strong points, or in these concrete pillboxes. So that the only thing you could do was to get forward and use them when you had an opportunity of getting troops in the open. Now, you've got in histories and so on, they said, of course, we started the attack with so many guns in this sector. So many guns, most of those were the field artillery, 4.5s and 18-pounders, and then firing shrapnel. So our gun strength behind was not what it was shown, and there was nobody seeing, really, in the last result, where these shells were bursting and what effect. All right. The other thing, of course, was in the Battle of Loos, yeah, and in the final lot of Cambrai, when the higher staff optimistically thought that we could develop into a main push from what was a raid, we only had cavalry corps. In this case, there were six divisions of cavalry behind. Absolutely useless, poor souls. This really went on till the end of the war. And we started the next war with cavalry corps, half abroad and half at home. Well,
can I just ask, what were the practical difficulties of, you had a forward observation post at this pillbox at Wijndrecht. What were the practical difficulties as an observation officer on the in the Ypres area, with the landscape being so featureless? How did you cope?
Well, you didn't. You watched to see if there was any movement and so on. That was all you could do. The only thing I was supposed to do when you came to the next phase of the attack, that you brought hundreds and hundreds of guns, most, even the heavies, they were shooting at nothing if it was completely vulnerable, if you understand what I mean. And the Germans are in great depth. At any rate, we come now to a thing that affected me very much, and that was October the 4th, where on the left of the line, that was our corps, the French and so on, we were to attack from where our infantry had arrived at, and that was at the valley with the Steenbeek, small river, it was hardly a river, a shocking place. And at this time also, the Germans had brought masses of gas into the picture, mustard gas. And this, of course, was another great thorn in our side. At any rate, the colonel got me out in front and he said, "You're for it, boy, this time, and you'll be the FOO with this attack." So I got my signalers in advance, a very gallant lot, the three of them. And I thought, how am I going to make sure that we keep in contact? Now, the normal thing to do was to run out two lines, there and back, so to speak, the other one being the earth. And that made two lines which could be broken quite easily. So I thought, well, we'll risk it. Secrecy doesn't matter when you're in the attack. So we'll have one line only. And when we get to a certain point, we'll leave one signal with Lucas lamps and other forms of contact and see how that goes. I had three splendid signalers with me, marvelous fellows, all fortunately decorated for the end of the war. They were fellows who, if the lines were broken, in any circumstances, would go out. You give them a tot of rum, but they'd go out and work there under most horrible conditions. They're a marvelous lot. So I knew that I'd got marvelous help in taking these fellows. Well, we went down the line, and the duckboards ahead, and I'd say that where it was, that Colonel Vickery in the house with the leading tree, and so that was slightly higher, and I think I said to you that the Belgians on our left, or the French, I'm sorry, French on our left, they were able to have fairly deep dugouts. So we weren't comfortable there, but it was at least higher. You could make a little shallow business to help with the guns and the men too. And on one occasion, we were under counter-battery fire the whole time. This is why they call it the gunner battle. While the infantry, poor souls, they at least had a gap in between attacks,